From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Even though it's been almost a year since the presidential election, the fallout continues to reverberate. A majority of Republicans still believe the presidency was stolen from Donald Trump, who refuses to admit defeat and fabricates allegations of voter fraud. The House is investigating the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, when Trump supporters tried to thwart the election and threatened to hang then-Vice President Mike Pence. Our guest Robert Costa with Bob Woodward give a behind-the-scenes account of this dangerous time in their new book, aptly titled Peril. It covers the tumultuous final months of the Trump administration and the first months of the Biden administration dealing with one crisis after another. Robert Costa is national political reporter for The Washington Post. You can join our conversation, and it all comes your way after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks open mixed this morning after a disappointing jobs report from the Labor Department. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 27 points in early trading.
U.S. employers added just 194,000 jobs last month as the pandemic continues to weigh on the economic recovery. Forecasters had expected a pickup in job growth after anemic gains in August, but instead the pace of hiring slowed further. The jobs number may be artificially depressed by seasonal adjustments. The Labor Department typically discounts hiring by school districts in the fall, and those tweaks have been thrown off by pandemic disruptions in the school calendar. Restaurants and retail shops added jobs last month after cutting workers in August. That suggests people are getting more comfortable about eating out and spending money as the late summer spike in coronavirus cases wanes. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Reports from Afghanistan say an explosion has ripped through a mosque in the northern part of the country. A spokesman for the Taliban says a number of people were killed and wounded. NPR's John Ruwich reports.
The explosion happened at a Shiite mosque in Kunduz province, which is not far from the border with Tajikistan. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid said in a tweet the blast took place on Friday afternoon, a time when Muslims traditionally congregate at mosques to pray. He did not say how many people were killed or wounded or what the source of the blast is believed to have been. The Taliban have been grappling with a string of attacks in recent weeks from the local Islamic State affiliate. Last week, Islamic State claimed responsibility for a deadly bomb blast at the entrance of a mosque in Kabul. Taliban forces have arrived at the scene in Kunduz and are investigating. John Ruwich, NPR News, Islamabad.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has awarded this year's Nobel Peace Prize to two journalists, Dmitry Muratov of Russia and Maria Ressa of the Philippines. Both have worked to expose deadly government corruption. The Nobel Committee says they represent efforts by journalists to protect freedom of expression. Maria Ressa founded the online site Rappler in the Philippines. She says her work is vital.
There is no better time to be a journalist. You know, the times when it's most dangerous is the times when it's most important, right? So this is the best time to be a journalist. If you're just starting out, this is, journalism will test you mentally, so intellectually, physically, spiritually, morally. You learn to draw the lines.
She spoke to the BBC. President Biden is poised to announce that he is restoring the original boundaries of two large national monuments in Utah. That's the Bear's Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante monuments. They have been drastically reduced in size by former President Donald Trump. The lands are sacred to several Native American tribes. But Utah's Republican governor says Biden is overreaching. It's Congress that must pass laws to protect public lands. You're listening to NPR News.
Good morning. It's 10:04. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. This is WHYY News. We've heard a lot recently about redrawing congressional maps in our region after the results of the 2020 census. But in the coming months, Philadelphia City Council will also be redrawing its district map. It's been a rocky process in the past. In 2001, council members went 5 months without pay during an impasse. They ended up with a map that had some of the most gerrymandered districts in the country. The current map, drawn in 2011, is considered a lot fairer. Pat Christmas with the Good Government Group Committee of 70 says he's not expecting a lot of big changes this time.
So the map on its face right now, I think a lot of Philadelphians will probably be okay with where the boundary is. And so a lot of the public feedback may actually be quite affirmative.
Council has until February 2022 to finish a map. The underground subway concourse below South Broad Street is held up by 200 concrete pillars. Maybe you've noticed them before, but you're very likely to notice them now. Those pillars have been painted with colorful designs thanks to a team of people experiencing homelessness and economic insecurity. Called Lovely Day, the project of Mural Arts Philadelphia employed hundreds of people hired as day laborers. Artist Alvin Toll trained the rotating crew of painters.
We get them. We go in. We work hard to pull out their creativity from individuals that have been closed in for whatever reason, trauma, you know, mental issues. We try to break that barrier and just get right into where creativity overcomes all that.
Each day, Mural Arts paid 10 people $50 to work on the concourse. It took over a year to paint. This is the third project in the SEPTA concourse under Center City to be painted by Mural Arts' day labor program called Color Me Back. Checking the weather now. Beautiful day today. Probably want to take advantage of it. High 78, low 62, mix of sun and clouds, light winds. Saturday should be dry, but expecting pretty heavy cloud cover, high 71. And then Sunday, some rain in the forecast, high 70. This is WHYY.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Tire Rack, offering a selection of tires, shopping tools, and user reviews to help people find the right tires for their car and driving conditions. Learn more at TireRack.com. And Americans for the Arts.
I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. There is still much we don't know about the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Members of the mob are still being identified and tried in court. A House committee is investigating the assault. And the Senate Judiciary Committee just released a report about how former President Trump and a Justice Department lawyer tried to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Our guest Robert Costa with his co-author Bob Woodward reveal in their new book, Peril, that another lawyer named John Eastman met with Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence in the Oval Office in early January with a 6-point plan to steal the election from Joe Biden. Pence, in the end, did not sign on and went on to certify the election results hours after a mob erected a gallows on the National Mall and chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." Costa and Woodward write in their book that Trump told Pence after he did his duty, "You betrayed me. I made you. You were nothing." This is just one of many scenes from the book about this dangerous and tumultuous period after the 2020 election. And Robert Costa joins us on Radio Times, national political reporter for The Washington Post. And Robert Costa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, great to be back with you.
Well, let me begin. We have a lot to cover. Let me just begin with some basic questions here. How close did we come to a coup after the 2020 election?
Well, Marty, you began by mentioning that meeting with John Eastman and Trump with Pence in the Oval Office, and that took place on January 4th, 2021, 2 days before the insurrection. And what we found in our reporting over 9-10 months is it was that period, the days before the insurrection, that were just as important or maybe even more important than what happened on the day itself, the day of the insurrection. What I mean by that is the president was not some passive participant in what happened on the 6th. He was driving this effort to decertify Biden's election in the weeks before, in particular the days before, and trying to get Pence to, in brief, throw the election to the House of Representatives through a roundabout way by throwing out electors, by saying that millions of votes shouldn't be counted and then the election should go to the House of Representatives. It was intense. It nearly happened. The president was pushing Pence and lawmakers until the absolute last moment.
Well, and Pence, I mean, he obviously ended up talking to another former vice president about what he should do. But how intense was that pressure on him?
For Mike Pence, it was a crucible. This is someone who began his career. I used to cover him in the House of Representatives, and he was a backbench conservative from Indiana. He used to joke with me and other reporters that he liked to call himself Rush Limbaugh on decaf. And that was who he was, this conservative, rank-and-file Republican. And his career gets transformed when Trump plucks him from the Indiana gubernatorial race in 2016. And he spends 4 years, as we all know, doing everything President Trump wants him to do. But at the end, it's Dan Quayle, of all people, right, his lawyers and others saying, "You just can't do it. Count the votes."
Well, Dan Quayle says to him, it's preposterous and dangerous that you can reject the results of an election. I mean, and that is absolutely true. There's absolutely no question about that. And yet Pence at least was willing to consider it.
No doubt about it. And it's understandable when you talk to people close to Pence. He has ambition. He wants to be in power. He wants to stay close to President Trump. Sometimes you recognize as a reporter that this isn't some episode of West Wing where some politician like Mike Pence is going to have a dramatic breakup with orchestral music in the background saying, I'm going in a different direction. This is sometimes messy, muddy politics, and Pence was navigating his own ambition, his desire to run for president in 2024 as the successor to the Trump movement, and of course, most importantly, navigating the law.
Well, let me ask you just one or two questions about John Eastman, a member of the Federalist Society. He spoke at that rally on January 6th saying anyone that is not willing to stand up and vote to overturn the election does not deserve to be in office. What's his fate today? What's he doing today?
Well, it still remains notable that John Eastman's out there practicing law. What we found is that this is not just a lawyer who was talking with Trump, and this was not just chit-chat inside the Oval Office. There was a plan memorialized in writing, 2 pages, 6 points, yeah, about how to throw the election to the House for Pence to make sure that the House Republicans ultimately decide who's president of the United States. And this was not just an email inbox memo. Mike Pence gets it, his lawyers get it, and they're saying to Pence repeatedly, listen to John. And another thing we discovered that I think is very critical to understand is that there was not just the pressure point on Pence. Senator Mike Lee of Utah, the chief kind of legal mind in the Senate GOP, also gets the memo, and he's told by the White House, take this seriously. And the conclusion we have as reporters is that this was a widespread pressure campaign, and imagine if they had bought in to the Eastman memo. You would have had, at the very least, something on the brink of a constitutional crisis because a major party would not be recognizing a presidential election.
Let me quote something that now former Vice President Pence said this to Sean Hannity, and this is talking about the insurrection. He says, I know the media wants to distract from the Biden administration's failed agenda by focusing on one day in January. They want to use that one day and demean the character and intention of 74 million Americans who believe they could be strong again and prosperous again and supported our administration in 2016 and 2020. He is talking about people who wanted to hang him.
And it was not just one day in January. This was not just a day where a rally spirals out of control and no one's really sure what happened, and it's a shame it happened. Our reporting is what leads to our assessment of all this, and our reporting shows that this was the culmination of a weeks-long attempt to change the course of American democracy, and that it was not just about violence at the Capitol that day. It was about bringing American democracy in a totally different direction. And that testing of democracy remains, and it's not just one day in January. I mean, Biden called that whole period in his inaugural address a winter of peril, but that winter of peril has become a spring of peril, a summer of peril, and now a fall of peril.
And maybe even a next spring of peril, because it seems that it is ongoing. Let me just roll back the clock a little bit, because even before the election, then President Trump was really laying the groundwork because he kept saying the results are going to be fraudulent. I mean, his pollsters must have been telling him that you're in trouble and you could lose this thing. And he kind of primed the pump.
He was priming it weeks before the election. As we all know, he was saying vote by mail is effectively an illegitimate way of voting. Too much of this is being done across the country. But what's notable is that in the days after the election, we report privately, Trump was saying to Kellyanne Conway and others, how did I lose to Joe Biden? How does this happen? How do I lose to that guy? And the most important thing of that conversation is he's saying the word lose.
Right.
Privately, he's acknowledging he lost. But it's then around November 6th and 7th, 2020, and chronology is everything, as Woodward has taught me, November 6th and 7th, Giuliani comes into the picture and says, this is stolen, and that becomes the refrain.
Well, it seems that Giuliani, as you referenced there, Robert Costa, is the person who got into Trump's ear. You do, and I'm going to kind of shrink down a couple of things that happens with Giuliani, where he's talking about affidavits to prove, you know, this false, you know, exactly, prove allegedly that there has been false voting. And he begins by saying, I have 8 affidavits. And then a little bit later, I have 27 affidavits. And then he finally says, no, I have 80 affidavits, all of which really are completely bogus.
That's such an important scene, too, because there is a Trump legal operation on the election side, on the Trump campaign, on Election Day, and they have a whole strategy to fight in the courts. But when Giuliani comes in on the weekend after the election and comes to the Arlington headquarters for Trump and starts throwing around the number of affidavits, seems to be just picking numbers out of thin air in the eyes of those around him. Then he goes to the Oval Office and just keeps escalating the number of affidavits. People around Giuliani and Trump, and they see the president nodding to Giuliani as he just keeps going on and on, they start to wonder, is this really a bizarre reality now? I mean, this is not a legal strategy anymore. This is a creation of a new reality.
Well, Trump even calls Giuliani crazy, but as you have him say in this book, but none of the sane lawyers can represent me because they've been pressured. What is he saying there?
If you think back to the Access Hollywood tape 5 years ago, one of the only people who would go on television after that episode was Rudy Giuliani. And Trump has always looked at Giuliani as someone who's a political soldier, someone who understands his New York instincts. And so he also knew that Giuliani was willing to bend facts, bend the perception of reality. And if they were going to just start going on and on about this election being stolen, it was good to have Giuliani out there hammering the point. And Giuliani hits the road and goes from court to court. But as we document, the courts kept saying there's no fraud here, sir, and they would throw out the cases.
Well, in fact, in Pennsylvania, a swing state and a prime example, there were a number, multiple court cases, and they were all tossed.
They were, and we see this across the board, and that's why the insurrection is kind of, it's the final inning, the ninth inning of this whole winding process after the election. When they can't win in the courts, Giuliani and others say to each other in private, this is not working in the courts. What's our last tool? What's our last weapon? Mike Pence.
Mike Pence is sort of the last play.
The last play that they have. You can't win in the courts. You got to win through the vice president, somehow twisting the Constitution to throw the election to the House. And that's where January 6th was not originally a date for even a rally. This is all fluid during the transition. It's not like January 6th was on people's radar on November 4th. January 6th becomes the target when everything else fails.
And we're almost up in a break here, but during that day, or maybe even in the afternoon at the White House, what is going on there?
On January 6th?
Yes.
Well, the president's having a rally in the morning, and then he's watching television, and he's not really paying attention or seeming to care when Pence is in trouble over at the Capitol. And he's isolated in the West Wing and not really responding. But he had put everything into motion to have this kind of disruption on January 5th, and we can talk about that later. January 5th, to me, is the key day.
Well, we have 30 seconds. Why so?
Because that's when Trump, one-on-one with Pence, spends an hour with him saying, you got to do this for me. And he has the temptation of power for Vice President Pence. Wouldn't it be cool, Mike, he says, pointing out to the mob gathering on Pennsylvania Avenue, wouldn't it be cool if they said you had the power to change an election? And Pence says no, but this is the temptation of power. And Trump becomes infuriated when Pence just won't break. 4 years of doing everything Trump wants, this time he won't.
Well, and Trump does tweet out on that morning as well to put even more pressure on then Vice President Mike Pence. That's Robert Costa, our guest on Radio Times today. You probably know that he and Bob Woodward have a new book. It's called Peril, And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Ready, Set, Philly. Hey, Philly, it's been a while. Are you ready to get back? Back to your city, back to your coworkers, back to your friends, and back to your life. It's finally time. The city is ready to welcome you back with happy hours, barbecues, street festivals, shopping, restaurants, and more. You can plan your triumphant return today at ReadySetPhilly.com. That's ReadySetPhilly.com.
As I walk.
There's a new 20th anniversary edition of Nick Lowe's album The Convincer that was first released on 9/11. On the Next Fresh Air, the interview and performance he recorded for us then, including a fitting version of his famous song What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, and the session we recorded 10 years later. Join us.
Is all hope gone?
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Doane Academy, located in Burlington, New Jersey. Enrolling students ages 3 through 12th grade, Doane Academy provides a challenging college preparatory program in a community where all students are known, loved, and encouraged to develop their unique potential. Learn more about the school and the application process at their open houses Sundays, October 17th and November 14th. Admission application deadline is February 1st. Details at doaneacademy.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Washington Post reporter Robert Costa, co-author with Bob Woodward of Peril. It's their account of the tumultuous few months following the 2020 election, one of the most dangerous periods, as it turns out, in our nation's history. Robert, let me read just an email from Patricia, and then I do want to talk about Attorney General William Barr, who features prominently in this book. Patricia says, I'm deeply frustrated at seeing the people who participated in the January 6th coup attempt and who are getting off with light sentences once convicted, defying subpoenas, walking free without even an indictment, and the lawyers who have not been disbarred. How is it they avoid justice for taking part in a coup attempt? Do you have an answer for her?
Well, this is an unfolding story right now. I mean, think about last night, Thursday night. Yeah. There are four Trump allies, former advisors, who have subpoenas. And you're supposed to respond to a subpoena. Our system, reporters, Marty, you and I, when we go out and talk to people, we only have our notebook and pen in hand and a recorder. Congress has subpoena power. And the Trump allies involved with the January 6th insurrection are refusing to even comply with Congress, despite Trump being out of power. They're citing executive privilege. So the January 6th committee is stymied at this point from getting testimony from people who really know what was going on behind the scenes. And in fact, if you read two of those subpoenas, the one for Dan Scavino, Trump's social media director, another for former Trump strategist Steve Bannon, our book is cited as the reason these subpoenas, part of the reason they were issued, because our book shows Trump directly involved with coordinating different pressure points. And that's the key thing that the committee's trying to figure out. Beyond all the hundreds of people that have been arrested by the Department of Justice for participation in an insurrection, what about the person at the top of the power structure, Trump himself? And that's the picture that still needs to be painted even more.
Do you feel like you can answer that? Or as you say, this is an ongoing story?
No, I think we've tried to really answer much more of it in this one important sense, that when January 6th happens, you probably remember, and I did because I read the stories too, that Trump was some kind of passive person, watching TV, in the dining room off the Oval Office, just kind of tweeting and not really taking it seriously on the 6th. And it's true on the surface level, and we have those scenes in the book, he's kind of passive in the afternoon on January 6th. But on January 5th, January 4th, January 3rd, he's doing everything possible, calling everyone, beating into Pence politically and personally to try to make sure the election's thrown to the House of Representatives. And that you see in the scenes in the book with Dan Scavino, he's in the Oval Office saying on the night of the 5th, what else can we do to pressure these lawmakers? What else can we do? So they want to talk to Scavino. And with Bannon, he's talking to Bannon even in December of 2020 by phone. This was not previously known. And Bannon has acknowledged this publicly on his podcast, talking to Trump, we need to make 6th of January the focus. We need to kill the Biden presidency in the crib. What a visceral thing to say.
Indeed. And I said I wanted to talk about William Barr, but let me ask you about Jeffrey Clark. And this is related to the Senate report that was released yesterday. He, part of the Justice Department. Who is he and what did he want to do?
So he comes into the Attorney General's job after Barr leaves in December. And Barr and Trump had had a falling out. They essentially stopped speaking. Barr was a political ally in every sense to Trump, trying to do what he wanted. And then when Barr leaves after with some friction with Trump, Clark comes in and Rosen comes in. And there,
Rosen is the acting AG.
Rosen's the acting AG.
Right.
And you see Trump continuing to say to the Department of Justice, you got to find fraud. Tell me there's fraud. There's got to be something else going on here. And of course, there's not. But if this is not just an isolated thing happening, Trump, based on our reporting, wants the DOJ to get examples of fraud so he can tout it and say that Congress can't recognize the election. It's all about getting Congress to not recognize it, and to make a better case to Congress, he wants the DOJ to back up his claims.
Well, and he wants to overturn the election. I mean, he says this multiple times.
He does. And he says, and Barr does a lot to help Trump, even in the transition. Barr says, we're not saying anybody in this book's a hero or a villain. We're just trying to show you what really happened. And it's very clear Barr's trying to put U.S. attorneys on the case to find fraud. He's encouraging the president to kind of take his time to figure it all out after the election. This is the sitting attorney general, supposed to be a nonpartisan position. It's very clear in our reporting he shares the president's political views, likes Trump personally. But at the end of the day, even Barr, who like Pence, wants to help Trump, can only go so far.
Well, let me ask you about Barr, because when I read it, I felt like, gosh, I've never met the man, but this is not the William Barr that I would recognize from his public pronouncements. You know, we know when the Mueller report came out and we couldn't get our hands on it, that he misrepresented what was in the report. As you write in this book, he opposed mail-in ballots, saying that there was potential for fraud when there's absolutely no proof that there's potential for fraud for ballots. You have him in a scene really reading the Riot Act to the then President Trump about how his supporters and people in the suburbs are viewing his brashness, using some very colorful language. Help us understand who this Barr is, who was being pretty in your face when it came to talking to President Trump.
When I said Trump plucked Pence out of gubernatorial obscurity, in a way it was the same for Barr. Barr had been attorney general for George H.W. Bush back in 1992 and had been out of power for many decades, had been in the private sector making millions of dollars. And then he sees an opportunity to come back to be attorney general. He writes a memo to Trump about the Russia investigation. Trump loves it, brings him in as attorney general. And Barr is someone who's an establishment conservative Republican, but really fits himself into the Trump presidency, enjoys it at first, likes this guy, wants to help him. And in April 2020, he starts to almost act as a political strategist for Trump while being sitting attorney general. Says voters think you're an expletive. You think you're an expletive genius. This is a problem. You're going to lose. But he, like so many people around Trump, they want to be his guide and advisor, and they don't really want to speak out publicly against him. He's the key to them having positions of power. They think somehow he'll find his way. But ultimately, almost every one of them, to a person, is disappointed and finds their relationship fractured or some way destroyed.
Well, and I have to say, reading his account, and there are other people in this book as well, Gina Haspel, you know, she's worried about a coup. These are all members of the government who, frankly, could have spoken out while all this was going on, and perhaps it would have precipitated some kind of constitutional crisis, but nonetheless would have given the public a better sense of what was actually happening inside the administration.
Well, that's a theme throughout this book, and we're trying to show what happens in what Woodward calls secret government. I mean, there's so much now that happens outside of the public view, and the public is in this country runs the government, but they don't know a lot sometimes about what's happening. We didn't know about the national security emergency. And to think Gina Haspel,
right,
the CIA director, she believes that the country's on the brink of a right-wing coup, And she also believes that Trump could lash out and attack Iran during the transition. This scene hasn't gotten almost enough attention. Sometimes there's almost too much in this book. That Trump has this meeting about attacking Iran and starts really sounding eager about all the different options to attack Iran. And Haspel calls Milley and says, what are we going to do here? Are we going to lash out for his ego? And then when Trump fires the Secretary of Defense on November 9th, Mark Esper, the whole national security military establishment wonders, are we next? Is he just going to start gutting this in the final days?
But did they stay because of their own access to power? Did they stay because they felt they could control Trump's impulses? Did they stay because they were afraid of him?
History's going to be the judge of this. I'm not a psychiatrist, and it is a very important question you're asking, and I ask it myself a lot when I was reporting this with Bob. Is why didn't some people speak out more? Now, some argued to us privately as we're sitting there doing these long interviews, having sandwiches, that they felt it was just better for them to stay. But others, privately, sometimes you could tell they had a sense of regret to not have said more. And what you really see when you report these kind of books is people are human, sometimes for the best, sometimes for the worst, in how they respond to enormous pressure. And it's one trait I find in a lot of people in the government, whether Republican or Democrat, is when you talk to them, that they really believe these are A-type personalities, that they can kind of manage this, they can manage him. And they find that in this particular situation with this president, they just could not.
You and Bob Woodward use quotations. You know, I'm thinking of William Barr as an example. I mean, you weren't there when he was talking to then President Trump, but there are quotations. So you're taking Barr's word for it?
Well, we don't discuss who we talk to because the whole— now, we're not trying to be mysterious or secretive about this, but Woodward's method, and I agree this is a smart method, is called deep background. And in the shortest way of explaining this, we use everything we collect and confirm, and we do all the interviews and we, on that basis, and record them all. We study the transcripts, and we just continue to build scenes with details. But we don't discuss who we learn different things from, because we really want people to empty their pockets in terms of sharing their notebooks, opening up their email inboxes, showing us their phone logs, journals, diaries, and recounting what actually was said, because we want to get away from the spin as people recount things, not some kind of formal version of events, but what really happened.
I mean, I feel like I kind of figured out who you might have talked to and who you didn't. But
well, I'll let you guess.
I will leave it there.
Speak up if they want about their participation
fair
or
enough.
Lack of participation.
Yeah, fair enough. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Robert Costa, national politics reporter for The Washington Post, co-author of this new book that's getting a lot of attention with Bob Woodward, and it is titled Peril. And it is the last months of the Trump administration, including those tumultuous few months between the election and the inauguration of Joe Biden, and it also covers the first couple of months of the Biden administration. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always pick up the phone at 1-888-477-9499. General Milley sort of starts the book, and that's where we begin, and we're learning that he had a back-channel conversation with his counterpart in China, and China was worried in this tumultuous period that something terrible would happen, that somehow the U.S. and China would, if not be in war, there would be some kind of military involvement. Milley's a really interesting person, and I do remember when there was the protest at Lafayette Square in front of the White House, and he goes with then President Trump. He's in his fatigues, walking to that church while everyone is pushed away from that protest. Help us understand him.
That moment on June 1st, 2020 was such a crossroads for Milley personally, based on our reporting. This is someone from New England, spent decades in the military, now is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the senior officer in the U.S. military, prides his independence. And then he just is coincidentally wearing fatigues that day when he gets called over to the White House, and he gets pulled over to St. John's Square in Lafayette Park, and it feels almost like a riptide. And that's it for him and Secretary Esper, such a crossroads, because they knew at that moment that they were being used, that Trump wanted to use the military for his own political will, his own political gain. And you see from that moment on the antenna being up for Milley. He's not going to let it happen again. He's embarrassed by it. He wants to make sure he protects his integrity all the way through January 20th, 2021, during this Trump period. And Milley is someone who really starts to see the president declining. Our reporting shows he believes the president was in serious mental decline. As Milley testified under oath recently, he's not a psychiatrist, so he can't officially diagnose Trump, but at least anecdotally, he believed the president was in serious decline, shouting at military leaders, shouting at advisors, screaming matches inside of the Oval Office, and then refusing to concede. And what we were stunned by in our reporting, and that's why we put it in the beginning of the book, was that so much was happening behind the scenes on the national security level. This was not just a domestic crisis. The senior members of the U.S. military and national security apparatus thought the president's conduct could unravel to the point of being a total national security catastrophe. And it's not that President Trump wanted war, and this is a critical point. Mm-hmm. Milley didn't think Trump wanted war, but Milley was worried, along with others like Haspel, that any kind of conduct by Trump that was hard to understand or confusing could spur someone like the Chinese, who are active in the South China Sea, to start misinterpreting what was happening. And misinterpretation can be the seed of war.
You also include a transcript of a conversation between Milley and Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House. And she it says to him, talking about Trump, what he just did was something illegal, immoral, unethical, and nobody stopped him. Nobody at the White House. And include this really fascinating and, I would imagine, rather intense conversation between Milley and Pelosi.
And what a moment for history to have the Speaker of the House of Representatives talking with the senior military officer 2 days after an insurrection. And this is the transcript of the call. And it's raw. It's at times heated. And you see the Speaker, and she's not any novice Speaker. This is someone who's been on the House Intelligence Committee, knows these issues, is briefed on the most sensitive national security matters. She's calling up Milley and saying, I know the president's commander-in-chief, but you better be sure these nuclear weapons are under control. And Milley has to confront what he calls privately the absolute darkest moment of theoretical possibility, that even if Trump doesn't want to do something crazy, that he has to consider what happens if he does. And so Milley calls in the members of the National Military Command Center and says to them all, "You may." And these are the officers that run our nuclear arsenal 24/7. He says, if anyone calls... He doesn't reference Trump by name, but he says, if anyone calls and does anything out of the ordinary, you call me first before pressing that button. You call me. I'm part of the procedure. I'm part of this net.
That is really frightening. I know you have interviewed Trump. He was not interviewed for this book, but if you could have asked him, you know, at least one question based on all your reporting here, what would that have been?
For 10 years now, I've interviewed Donald Trump dozens of times, and I recognize that he does one thing more than any. He operates and makes decisions by the phone, doesn't use email, is very much on the phone in his residence late at night, sometimes plotting with people about how to decertify an election, how to stir up voter fraud claims. So if I could ask him one question, Marty, it would be, Mr. Trump, President Trump, could you please share your phone logs with me for January 5th and January 6th?
The phone logs, obviously. I mean, and that is one of these unanswered questions. That's what the House committee is trying to figure out, correct?
And so much of Trump is, what's he saying? Because remember with the Michael Cohen episode, he rarely puts anything on paper. Now, the Eastman memo is on paper. That's Eastman doing it. But Trump himself is a phone caller. So who was he calling? We know he spoke to Pence. We know he then called Bannon and Giuliani after he speaks to Pence. We know on January 5th. And then he calls all of his aides into the Oval Office to pressure lawmakers on the 5th. Who else was he talking to? What was the level of coordination? Because Woodward used to tell me that the thing about Watergate was that Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy were what he called the operational commanders of the Watergate criminal conspiracy. They were the ones setting it into motion. And the real unanswered question for our book, after we did spend all these months reporting it, and for the January 6th committee, is this: who were the operational commanders of the January 6th insurrection? In other words, you have a rally at the Ellipse, Trump speaks, and then suddenly there's kind of this coordinated attack on the Capitol. How does that happen?
Well, I'm going to let that question hang out there. That is Robert Costa, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the book that he co-authored with Bob Woodward. It's called Peril. And we got people with lots of questions here. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
The World Health Organization this week called it a historic moment, and scientists agree.
This is a major step forward for the protection of the human race against malaria.
On the Friday News Roundup this week, more on a groundbreaking vaccine, the latest on this year's Nobel Peace Prize, and the fallout from the Pandora Papers. Next time on 1A. Weekday mornings at 11 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper. If you've been diagnosed with lung cancer, you need a team of experts with you every step of the way. The lung cancer team at MD Anderson at Cooper is committed to providing patients personalized care and innovative treatments like robotic surgery, immunotherapy, and advanced radiation treatment, all close to home. At MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper, no one fights cancer alone. Appointments available within 24 hours.
WHYY, your local PBS and NPR station, and 6ABC have teamed up for Confronting the Crisis, Gun Violence, a powerful community conversation with scholars, political leaders, and activists sharing insights, recommendations, and potential solutions for the city's gun violence crisis. This conversation is facilitated by me, Christopher Flood, the drummer Norris, and 6ABC anchor Shari Williams.
Today at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Robert Costa about his book that he co-authored with Bob Woodward, and it's titled Peril. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Clyde: what evidence is there of any cooperation between the Trump White House and the organizers of January 6th? And I think, Robert Costa, you were just saying there's so many unanswered questions about that day and the day leading up to that. Is that one of them?
It is. And look, John Eastman and President Trump speak on the 6th at the rally, and we didn't really understand at the time what was Eastman and Trump talking about. Trump has a passage in his speech on January 6th where he says all Mike has to do is delay everything, listen to John Eastman, delay the certification. And it seemed kind of incoherent when we first heard it as reporters. But then we realized there was a whole memo and pressure campaign behind the scenes. And the New York Times editorial board really nailed it this past Sunday, referencing our book and how January 6th is far worse than we previously understood, and it has to be seen now as more than just the riot at the Capitol that became an insurrection. It was about a broader effort that was legal, political, and ultimately physically violent.
There were, on that day, that night, I guess, 147 Republicans who voted against certifying the election results. How do you understand what the Republican Party is these days?
It's a party that is still with Trump. Look at all the polls. Even though he was impeached twice and linked to an insurrection and drove it as president, he's still the most popular Republican in the country. And he's poised to come back in 2024 if he chooses to run. And what does that tell us about the Republican Party? They believe he has political capital. Even after an insurrection, Senate Republicans did not convict him. And nothing's changed in that dynamic. Mm-hmm. And that the party, the fight in this country now politically is not so much about spending. And that's part of it. We're all watching that fight on Capitol Hill. But it's not so much red and blue anymore or partisan. It's about how do these people in power see democracy? And American democracy is on the table as the issue in a way it really hasn't been in recent decades, if not recent centuries. And that's changed this country's political debate Because you're usually saying I'm liberal or conservative, but now the discussion is more, are you worried about democracy and its fragility or not? And that's why some Republicans like Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney are joining the January 6th committee, believing this is an apocalyptic moment for American democracy, while others are saying we want Trump to come back. Even Lindsey Graham, who knew the president was voicing conspiracy theories on the election, is his biggest defender and rehabilitator.
You know, it's funny, as you were just talking there, I just scribbled the word Lindsey Graham because I wanted to ask you about him, because he seems to exemplify this, especially within the Republican Party, this very strange relationship with Donald Trump.
He's a prism. He is a prism, and that's why he's an important character in this book. Because remember, in 2016, he runs for president himself and says Donald Trump is the worst possible human being on earth. That's Lindsey Graham. I mean, he said it repeatedly. But when Trump comes in, he adapts and changes. So does so much of the Republican Party. Even someone like Paul Ryan, the House Speaker at the time, who can't stand President Trump, studies narcissistic personality disorder psychiatric manuals to try to understand this man. He ultimately works in a transactional way to get things done. And they get a lot done. I mean, let's never forget power is about getting what you want. And the Republicans for years from Trump got what they wanted: tax cuts, regulatory action to, as Bannon would say, deconstruct the administrative state, Supreme Court justices, an overhaul of the federal judiciary that's changed the court for a generation. They got a lot in return, but the cost now is that the fabric of American democracy, in the eyes of many people on right and left, is frayed and fraying.
In fact, Mitch McConnell says it was a hell of a 4 years.
McConnell says in our book, privately to others, that there are many Malok's moments. And McConnell, he's another prism. I mean, this is someone who despises Trump behind the scenes, mocks him repeatedly. We show that in scene after scene. He's calling Trump a fading brand. He's from Kentucky, where they have all the races for horses, and he calls Trump an off-the-track thoroughbred. Wow. But McConnell now knows that Trump still has influence. And John McLaughlin, Trump's pollster, goes to see the president over the summer and says, you got everybody in the palm of your hand. The voters love you. They side with you with your grievances. And then Brad Parscale, Trump's former campaign manager, confides to others over the course of this past summer, Trump had an army for Trump. He wants the army back. He wants it back. And if he runs again, it's going to be for vengeance.
For vengeance. In fact, yeah, you use that word in this book. Let me just ask you a couple of other things. Again, behind the scenes, Mike Pompeo is quoted as saying the crazies are taking over. And he's talking about Powell, you know, the pillow guy, Mike Flynn. Barr talks about the clown car. This is referring to Powell again, and to Giuliani. So, again, you've got these people behind the scenes. They see the clown car, the crazies, working the president.
And Secretary Pompeo, who wants to run for president, also a very careful lawyer, was asked about some of these conversations on a Fox interview. And he just said, I don't recall some of these conversations. You see in Pompeo someone with a lot of ambition, just like Pence, wants to be in the game with Trump. And he's not prepared to go have some kind of public clash at this moment. And they all see Trump has the power source. Maybe Trump runs, maybe he doesn't. But if he doesn't, they want to be there as a Trump successor with his blessing.
And they want to run against him, too. I mean, it looks like Mike Pence wants to run for president.
It's going to be interesting to see if Pence actually runs against Trump. Possible, but I don't really see it at this point. He's still trying to thread that needle to be someone who doesn't have Trump's total wrath. If Trump decides for some reason not to run, Pence wants to be seen as a likely or understandable successor. But our book shows the president still fumes about Pence behind the scenes, so it's going to be something to watch.
Indeed. Let me read a couple of more emails, and let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation another 10 minutes or so with our guest Robert Costa. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. A bunch of questions about January 6th. Michael says at every protest in D.C., there is a significant troop presence, but not on January 6th. This was by design. Mike believes if they had been stationed outside the Capitol, there would have been no breach. Secretary of Defense Miller wrote a memo restricting what the Guard could do that day. Can you add to that, Robert Costa?
And we're going to still have to learn more about what the Pentagon was doing. But our reporting shows that January 6th was an intelligence failure. And we note that at the end, in this sense, that they were prepared for a possible air attack on the Capitol, a national security threat. They were very on edge about that, that maybe a foreign adversary would try to disrupt the proceedings on the 6th in some way. But they were not prepared for a domestic attack, and the Capitol was vulnerable. And part of this is a little bit of a hangover from the summer of 2020,
yeah,
and the response in Washington to the George Floyd protests. The mayor of Washington, many others, were very hesitant, including the Department of Justice, the FBI, of having an over-police presence on January 6th. So you had those dynamics. You had the military focus more on the national security element than the domestic element. And ultimately, it enables this group, this mob, to storm the Capitol in. There are only a few places in the Capitol where you have windows that don't have bars on them. They get through them, and as we all know, it was a chilling scene that we'll never forget. But it's more about – there's more questions to be asked about the Capitol Police, about the National Guard. I mean, this whole scene, in multiple scenes in the book, of people pleading with the National Guard to come out, and Milley calls Pence to get the National Guard, and the National Guard's over at this small fort near the Capitol, but it still takes time to get everybody together. There's the lack of preparation for a domestic attack is jarring in hindsight.
But and the question is, it incompetence, or is it something, you know, even worse than that, by design?
Well, it's something for the January 6th committee to explore. The intent on some of this, was it mistake, or was it with the intent of a lack of attention on the Capitol building? We show that the National Guard's prepared to come, but they're not stationed. And it's also hard. There was not a belief from a lot of people that the Capitol could be breached. I mean, there's just now it seems so obvious. Of course, the Capitol could have been breached by a mob, but that just wasn't the sense, even at the highest levels of the military. Our reporting shows that that somehow was possible, and that again was an intelligence failure.
Let me read some more questions. One from James. He says, what can an American do as we watch our democracy in peril? We see Facebook propagating misinformation, voter rights suppression. What can be done? You have any ideas for that?
Well, as a reporter, I would just offer this. Do not look away. It's very easy to say you're exhausted. I don't want to pay attention to Trump, people tell me. I don't want to watch any of this anymore on TV. I'm just tired. I don't want to look at anything. I don't want to read anything. And I just say, well, don't look away. Because Woodward and I, we watch these Trump rallies. He's speaking for 90 minutes to 2 hours over the summer, now over the fall. He's going to Iowa in a day or two. And in these rallies, he's saying, it's like a wartime cadence. I'll never surrender. Yeah. I'll never give in. We should never stop fighting. The election was stolen. This is very real, very current. This book is not just looking back in the past, and the story is not in the past. So you really can't look away when your democracy, your country is going through this kind of turmoil.
Here's a comment from Noel who says, all the hard facts are there, and yet his supporters refute them. How can we protect our democracy? I mean, you know, you live in the world of reporting and trying to get facts out.
And this is going to be a real debate about, social media in the future. Should social media companies be some kind of public utility like an electric company? Because the lack of regulation for some of these private corporations has sparked a ton of debate on right and left, whether they have too much power. The right thinks they have too much power to deplatform people and to block people. And many on the right and left especially are worried that so much misinformation is going on out there, whether it's about the vaccine or the election.
I'm quoting from the very end of your book, and you and Woodward had interviewed Trump, I guess this was back in 2016, and your assessment of him, you write, we recognize he was an extraordinary political force, in many ways right out of the American playbook, an outsider, anti-establishment, a businessman, a builder, bombastic, confident, a fast-talking scrapper. But we also saw the darkness. He could be petty, cruel, bored by American history, and dismissive of governing traditions that had long guided elected leaders, tantalized by the prospect of power, eager to use fear to get his way. And then you end with this very, what's the word? Well, you end with this two-word sentence, peril remains.
Yeah, and the question we ask is, to what lengths will he go to get power again? And who knows? No one really knows the answer to that question. How far will he go? You know, so many people, when I sat down with them to do interviews for this book, they would say, you know, Costa, when I first got to know Trump, I thought he was a child, and he could be controlled like a child. But ultimately, they conclude, he's anything but a child. This is very much an adult man who was an outsider to the presidency, but at the end of 4 years was fully comfortable with the presidency, knew how to pull the levers of power, to use the executive branch, and at times bend it to his will. And so the prospect of him coming back, not as this outsider learning his way like he was in 2017, bumbling around at times in the eyes of his advisors, but someone who really knows how to use the presidency to pressure Congress, to get things done, to make moves on national security. That's what's on the horizon. And he is very much out there, and people don't want to pay attention. But Republicans are welcoming him back. I mean, look at the welcome to him as he heads to Iowa.
Yeah.
They're applauding and roaring for the return of Trump.
Let me just put something else here that has nothing to do with what we were just talking about. But you have a scene here when Trump and Obama are riding to the Capitol for Trump's inauguration. And Trump asks Obama, what was your biggest mistake? And then you write, Obama paused and glanced at Trump. I can't think of anything, he said. Trump changed the subject. Is this the car you use all the time?
Jeez. I mean, what an awkward scene.
Really? I always wondered, like, what was that car ride like between these two men?
It's just what a historical scene and awkward. When we heard about it and confirmed it, we had to put it in because to think about Obama, this two-term historic president, the first black president in the United States, now sitting there with the former reality TV star, who is his successor, and he knows Trump will tweet and talk about anything you say to him. So Obama's very careful. What was your greatest mistake, President Obama? What was your greatest mistake? I can't think of anything. And then Trump just kind of, as Trump does, just changes the subject. You use this car a lot? And it's just, that was the beginning of the Trump presidency.
We're almost out of time here. What was it like to work with Bob Woodward?
He is a joy to work with. And we come from different generations. I'm almost 36. He's 78. But his approach is the old school way of just talking to people as much as possible, recording everything, reading transcripts. It's the method of hard work, building scenes, asking for documents. And sometimes he would kick me in the rear end and say, go knock on somebody's door. And when he knocks on people's doors, when he knocks on a general's door or a senator's door, they look at him and they go, Bob Woodward, you're still doing this expletive. You're still doing this. And so we just worked together to try to get the story. And we had what I call and he calls the luxury of time. While everyone, and I was a daily reporter for years, will remain a daily reporter. You're always hitting the deadline. But when you write a book, you can keep going back when everyone goes forward. And that's what we did.
Well, Robert Costa, you've been a guest on Radio Times for a lot of your professional career. Thanks for joining us. Once again.
Thank you, Marty. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And Robert Costa, our guest, co-author with Bob Woodward of the book called Peril. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler, with help today from Susan Greenbaum. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And 10 up next here on WHYY. It's 1A. And if you missed any portion of today's show, as I mentioned, you can download it as a podcast, and you can always check out the rebroadcast. It airs weeknights at 11 o'clock right here on WHYY. Have a great weekend and join Mary Cummings Jordan this Monday for the Radio Times Regional Roundup.
Supporting WHYY, the Krefeld School, a small by design, gender-inclusive school for grades 7 through 12, Krefeld offers a college preparatory program that aims to empower students to find meaning in their learning, feel ownership of their school community, and graduate as self-aware, empathetic, lifelong learners. Located in Chestnut Hill, families can learn more at Krefeld's upcoming open house on October 21st. Info at krefeld.org. That's krefeld.org.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.